the cabbie was just introduced like two chapters ago. And now we're about to find out that he's going to be the next king of Narnia.
Someone's got to be king.
True, but it's never quite sat right with me.
It's not new to Aslan, though. It's not an introduction for Aslan. It's an introduction for us.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news, this
is Talking Beasts.
Today we're talking about Chapter 11 of The Magician's Nephew, which is in fact called Diggory and His Uncle Are Both in Trouble. But I really like Austin. In the Talking Beasts Facebook group, Austin suggested it could be called The Magician and His Nephew Are in Trouble.
Oh, that would have been good.
Missed opportunity.
Missed opportunities.
But it describes very well what's going on in this chapter that we're finally getting back to. We have, it starts with Diggory's uncle being in trouble and almost getting planted upside down because he gets mistaken for a tree, amongst other things. And then, so there's the kind of comical part of being in trouble. And then Diggory being in trouble is a little more serious. But we start off with a lot of humor. About half of this chapter, if not more, is just kind of the animals goofing off.
It's never bothered me. And I think that I like how Lewis goes there with like just the odd things of like a new world, right? Like, huh, like I guess they would see a person. They wouldn't know that it's not feathers, you know, because all they know are animals or in themselves, you know, reading it. I know we always, nowadays, especially with the films and stuff, we're always thinking, oh, how would they adapt this and that? Separate question.
Yes.
Different direction.
We should come to that.
Of conversation. But yeah. For the book, it's never bothered me. I've always enjoyed it.
I think for me, yeah, I would agree that when I was reading the book, you know, front to back, it never, like, it was just, oh, this is just a, you know, funny part of the story that kind of helps remind you that things are the same, but they're also really different. So there's some very understandable confusion. I think the feeling of it feeling too long or out of place actually comes if you just read the chapter in isolation, which is what I just did in preparation for this podcast, because you're like, okay, let's get back into the story of, you know, Narnia's coming together and everything. And it just starts off with this pages of dialogue about, well, what is he, you know? And you're like, okay, let's just, you're like, let's get to the other part of the story. But I think that only really happens if you're reading in isolation. I think if you read the chapter in context with the others, it fits in nicely.
I might disagree, because I think when you're reading it, if you're just really reading it, the book, if you're really in context, to me, it's interrupting. I want to get back to where's the witch and how are they going to get back to their world and the creation of Narnia? And like, I want to get back to that stuff. Whereas I found reading it in isolation was more, I wasn't feeling that, come on, let's get on with it as much. So I was just enjoying it more for what it was. So I think I had the opposite reaction to you there. Often with Magician's Nephew, it has kind of bothered me how it just kind of becomes a different book after they get into Narnia. And I was into that tension of what's going to happen with the witch. And then it was just, you know, let's talk about something else for a while. But this scene, and this scene in particular, I almost thought it was a little too silly at a point in the story where I was taking it really seriously and was super invested. But I had a very different reaction this time. First time really, it might be my first time reading this as this part of the story as a dad, I think. And I had a different reaction listening to the animals, them trying to figure out things about the world. And it's like, because they're essentially babies with a very developed vocabulary. Everything is new to them, but they're very good at expressing kind of what they're thinking and feeling. I've often looked at babies and just thought, because they have no frame of reference for anything. You know, what's that bit in Out of the Silent Planet, the first time Ransom, when he first steps onto Malacandra, and he looks around, his brain can't make sense of what he's seeing on this other planet. And Lewis writes, like, in order to see things, you have to know roughly what they are. Hmm. Like, what is it like for babies to look at things and have zero frame of reference? And that's what I thought, that's what I found was humorous in this chapter, but also really fascinating to think. Hmm. And it reminded me of, I just went to see Poor Things, which got nominated for a lot of Oscars. And similar idea where Emma Stone's basically playing, it's basically another Frankenstein story where Emma Stone is playing like she's an instantly fully formed adult, basically. So she has the vocabulary, but she's basically a baby in every other way. It's a fascinating thing. So that's what actually stood out to me this time, is what an interesting thing to explore with things look completely new to somebody, like a baby. What is that like? And that resonated with me so much more. And I think it's because I'm a dad now. Did that jump out at you at all, Rillian?
Yeah, no, I was definitely thinking about it today. They're all a day old, but Aslan's given them this gift of matured language, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of speaks to how we look so much at ourselves to understand other people.
Mm-hmm.
There's pitfalls in that we can, if you don't truly understand yourself, you're not going to really understand other people. It's one thing to have a mature understanding of yourself, your virtues, your flaws, what you're capable of, both good and bad. And then to understand, okay, this person is also a human like me. But sometimes when we have especially a very initial shallow view of ourselves, not that we don't like ourselves, but just like we don't truly mm-hmm. understand even ourselves. We'll look at other people and we'll project onto them. Well, mm-hmm. I would want this. So therefore they must want that same thing.
Mm.
Well, maybe not, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it reminded me of that and how they're, of course they think, well, he's out there. He's just going to want food, or he's just going to want water. Or he's just going to want to be planted. Or uh-huh. he's, you know, like what else could he want?
There's a certain logic to everything they're saying.
Yeah, it's not crazy.
I love the idea of them not knowing what clothes are and thinking that like the hat is part of the cabbie's body and stuff. I think that's just, that's so.
Right.
I told you it's a tree. I told you it was uh-huh. a tree, you know?
So I found that. So because I found that so much more intellectually stimulating this time, I think I was totally fine with it and love the idea of Lewis exploring that with humor. Anna in the Talking Beast Facebook group said, "The conversation between the Talking Beasts when discussing what to do with Uncle Andrew never ceases to make me smile." So I cannot deny that, even though it maybe spoils the momentum a little bit. Totally worth it. And there's a lot of great quotable stuff in here, too. Like, "I object to that remark very strongly." There's a lot of great stuff in this.
Yeah.
There was something in here that I completely forgot about that Michael posted about in the Talking Beast Facebook group. And Michael said, "I found it interesting that Uncle Andrew couldn't understand the Talking Beasts, but also the Talking Beast couldn't understand him." And I think that's what we talked about in the previous Magician's Nephew episode about why is it that Uncle Andrew was not able to understand what the Talking Beasts were saying. And I think it's a complicated kind of weird thing, but we were able to kind of make sense of what Lewis was doing. Why is it that though when Uncle Andrew speaks, the animals can't understand him? Now, apparently Diggory and Pollock, that they can understand Uncle Andrew, I guess, but the animals can't. Why would that be? You know, the previous chapter talked about the problem with trying to make yourself stupid is that you very often succeed. And that's essentially what Uncle Andrew does, why he can't understand speech anymore. But why would it work the other way, too?
I'd never noticed it. I'm even rereading it, wondering if it's really an apples and oranges comparison. Like, is it because he doesn't talk as much? He tries to say good doggy, and they kind of hear this sizzling noise. Maybe you're right. I'd never thought of it. I'd never noticed it or picked up on it. But also, I always thought that he was trying to talk, and they just couldn't understand what he was saying.
The Lewis writes that the animals were puzzled, and worst of all, he didn't seem to be able to talk. He had tried to when the bulldog spoke to him, or as he thought, first snarled and then growled at him. He held out his shaking hand and gasped, "Good doggy, poor old fellow," but the beast could not understand him any more than he could understand them. They didn't hear any words, only a vague sizzling noise. Perhaps it was just as well they didn't, for no dog that I knew, at least of all a talking dog of Narnia, likes being called a good doggy. So, a vague sizzling noise. It does seem like, for some reason, they're not able to understand what Uncle Andrew is saying right now. And the only thing I can think of is Aslan does warn them, you know, don't become like the dumb beasts again, or you might turn back into dumb beasts. And we talked about in the previous Magician's Nephew episode mm-hmm. about how Uncle Andrew is essentially taken a little step towards becoming like a dumb beast again. We know from the Narnia timeline, which how canon is that could be debatable, but Lewis talks about in the Narnia timeline that there were humans that do become, that they lose the ability to speak, basically. So I can see that maybe that's kind of what's happening here, but I don't get, like, why would Diggory and Polly be able to understand him, but the animals cannot? Does it have something to do with their innocence? That's the only thing I can think of. Something for the comments section. What do you guys think?
I wonder if they just don't even recognize him as a speaking being. And if you don't recognize an entity as something even willing to speak to you, you're not going to really pick up on it. Maybe that's because that's the way he sees them. He just sees them as dumb animals. They kind of see him as a dumb animal. So they're not, they're not looking, they're not listening for it.
Well, it's also like you have your, you know, your toddler, your baby who babbles, and mom and dad can pick out what they're trying to say, but a stranger is going to have no concept of what that child is saying because they don't understand that, you know, gobbledygook means this or that.
I would love to hear some thoughts on this in the comments section. It just seems like such an interesting idea that I don't have a very satisfying kind of conclusion to. But Uncle Andrew narrowly avoids getting buried headfirst, which, you know, I love. Maybe they can do an alternate version of the scene in the movie where he goes in headfirst and that's his comeuppance. That would be very darkly funny. And I think that's what Lewis is doing here, is the villain is getting his due here, utter humiliation. But moving on to more serious matters, Diggory plucks up the courage to walk up to the lion and say, "Could you give me some magic fruit to heal my mother?" And Aslan kind of ignores him and says, "This is the boy that did it. This is the boy that introduced the witch into my world."
I'm going to totally fall back on the parenting thing. Like, I mean, if your kid does something wrong, you know, there might be something that he or she wants, right? Like maybe they're hungry. Like, "Hey, can I have an apple or something?" And maybe you would say yes, but there's kind of a, whoa, we got to address this thing first. At some point, you have to learn there's a priority in terms of importance and what comes first. And so, I mean, I kind of go to that as a parent, like, you know, because there's lots of things your kid wants that you want to give them. But I mean, one of the best things is when your kid asks you something that they can have and you say, "Yes, I'd love to give you that thing." It's one of the best feelings, you know, because you get to say no so often. But sometimes you say, "No, but before that, you have to understand this, or you did this wrong thing, or we have to fix this situation or something."
Yeah. I think it's like you said, I think it's not that Aslan isn't going to help Diggory. Like, you, as we see later on, it's, you know that Aslan cares deeply for Diggory and for his mother, and, you know, he has the ability to feel that empathy for him and, you know, relate to him that in that way. But there's he doesn't want to leave Diggory where he's at in just, "You did these things and here's your fix, go off and live your life and have a nice day." It's like he wants to teach him something deeper, like the acknowledging of what you did, why you did it, and here's what you can do to help, and to give him that opportunity to make restoration, which is important for Diggory just as a person, just for his life going forward. I don't think he would have had the same kind of life experience if he had just been sent on his merry way and not been able to go through that experience of being able to actually
repent,
like make restoration for the things that he had contributed to.
Yeah, I think it just speaks to what a serious thing Diggory has done here in introducing a witch into this world. You know, before the world is a few hours old, there's an evil witch abroad in my new world. And I think Aslan's like, "Hey, before I can deal with this, Diggory, before I can give you the good news, we need to have a discussion about, we just have to have an acknowledgement here of what's just happened, because this is very serious." And I think that may be the reason for my experience reading the chapter this time was the first part of this chapter, where there's so much humor and the animals are so cute and so funny and just so innocent. And I think what that does is that leads right into Aslan saying, like, "This is the boy that did it." The first part of the chapter is saying, "Look at how innocent these creatures are, how innocent and pure this world is." And then, "Oh, there is an evil witch in this pure world, and how serious her presence here is." Everything else is so pure and innocent, and now the presence of the witch here, it used to be this stainless world, and now there's a big black dot on it, and that's such a tragedy. So to me, that humor at the beginning emphasizes this seriousness that Aslan wants Diggory to understand. One of my favorite lines here, and I think Focus on the Family did a pretty good job of this, when Aslan says, you know, how did the witch, you know, come to, I think, I can't remember the exact question, but like, how did the witch come into the wood or something like that? Diggory says, by magic. And it's obviously not enough. Aslan's like, yeah, keep going. But I love it because I imagine Diggory saying that line kind of dramatically, like, by magic, as if people are going to go, ooh, and then Aslan's like, not impressed. He's like, okay, more detail, please.
Why is she crying? She got hit in the head. Okay, yeah.
But I, you know. I imagine him saying that line like, by magic, as if this, like, having this like dramatic quality to it, like, and the Aslan's like, no, that's not what I'm getting at. Okay, I'm not impressed. Okay, and I don't know if I want them to do it that way in the movie, but I always saw a little bit of, always that part always makes me laugh.
I'm double check, is Greta a Patreon supporter? I can't remember.
But I always imagine, yeah, Diggory, like probably the literal way to do what I'm picturing is like the music builds a little bit. By magic, and you cut to Aslan's reaction, and the music just stops. He's just like, okay, more please. You know what I'm getting at, okay? But I always love that bit. There's a fascinating line where, and let me read it very direct from the book here, because this is so interesting. Aslan is talking to the cabbie, and he says, Lewis writes, son, said Aslan to the cabbie, I have known you long. Do you know me? Well, no, sir, said the cabbie, leastways not in an ordinary manner of speaking, yet I feel somehow, if I may make so free, as wow, I'll just read it, as I'm not going to do the accent, I feel as ow we've met before. It is well, said the lion, you know better than you think you know, and you shall live to know me better yet. So obviously this takes us right back to Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where Lewis says, you know, yeah, you know, the Pevensies are grieved to be leaving, and Lewis and Aslan says, I'm in your world too, but there I have another name. And obviously it's a complete mystery. No one knows what Lewis was talking about. It's just one of those coded things that we'll never know the answer to.
Right?
Yeah. He's God, okay? So obviously it's God in our world, and God takes a certain form in our world and other forms in Narnia. That's the whole idea behind behind Narnia. It's an allegory, right, Rillian?
No, it's not an allegory.
It's not an allegory.
It's a supposal, as C.S. Lewis said.
Suppose God, there's a God, and he manifests himself in a certain way in our world, maybe a different way in other worlds.
Let's suppose the same God that exists made other worlds and appeared in that and manifested himself in those worlds. What if there was a world where the animals were the people?
Right.
It wouldn't make sense for him to show up as a human.
Right. So not an allegory, because he's not saying he's like a symbol for God. He's literally like God.
Yeah, because if he's just a symbolic of it, doesn't really make sense.
Uh-huh.
How could he have known the cabbie and all of that? You know, so it doesn't.
Uh-huh. Poor Helen. just doing the laundry and then very suddenly not doing the laundry.
I don't know. My wife would be pretty thrilled if someone fucked her out of doing the laundry. She's like, I was in the laundry room. And now I'm here. I'm just going to accept it. I'm not going to second guess it at all.
It's a pretty cool piece of writing. Let me read this here too. Lewis writes, Aslan threw up his shaggy head, opened his mouth, and uttered a long single note, not very loud, but full of power. Polly's heart jumped in her body when she heard it. She felt sure that it was a call, and that anyone who heard that call would want to obey it, and what's more, would be able to obey it, however many worlds and ages lay between. So I tend to think of being thrust into another world as being this kind of violent thing, but it was very gentle for her, apparently. Do you guys buy, as happy as she might have been to not be doing the laundry anymore, do you buy her just not just losing her mind in that moment? She seems pretty like, okay, cool, I guess I'm going to be queen in like 5 seconds.
I personally don't think she really has a concept of what is actually going on. It's when something that fantastic happens to you and suddenly you're doing one thing and then you're not, and there's a lion talking to you and your husband is there and it's all very wonderful. I mean, a very great assumption would be that you've just had a heart attack and died and you are now in heaven. Like, this is not real.
Or you're dreaming, or you had been dreaming, or you woke up from the dreaming.
You know. Lewis writes, of course she thought she was dreaming. That was why she didn't rush across to her husband and ask him what on earth had happened to them both.
Exactly.
But when she looked at the lion, she didn't feel quite so sure it was a dream. Yet for some reason, she did not appear to be very frightened. Then she dropped a little half curtsy, as some country girls still knew how to do in those days. After that, she went and put her hand in the cabbie's and stood there looking round her a little shyly. So clearly Lewis is like, okay, for the sake of the story, we can't have half a chapter of getting Helen up to speed
and
acclimating her.
Later.
Like, what's Princess Bride? He says, let me explain. No, let me sum up. That's kind of what Lewis does here.
No, let me sum up.
That's good. I guess it kind of speaks to the larger problem I have of the cabbie. Was it just introduced like two chapters ago, and now we're about to find out that he's going to be the next king of Narnia. It's something
someone's
that's
got to be king.
True, but it's
Narnia was never right when a son of Adam.
It's never quite sat right with me.
It's not new to Aslan, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's not an introduction for Aslan. It's an introduction for us.
That's fair. But for me as the reader, I still felt a little bit.
You were fine with kids. What? According to timeline, like 14, 12. 10 and 8 becoming kings and queens, that sat well with you, but like...
No, it's not them becoming kings and queens at all. It's in terms of narrative. You know, like I mean, that's the end of what you're talking about with them, the Pevensies becoming kings and queens, right, is at the end of a 17-chapter book. Whereas this is, we just met the cabbie two chapters ago, and now it's, what? And then we didn't even know Narnia was going to be... Like, the whole creation of Narnia, that kind of comes out of nowhere. Like, two chapters ago, we know who this guy was. And in those two chapters, Narnia's been created, and this random guy is the king of it. I don't know. It's just, in terms of narrative, it's one of those things on an intellectual level I kind of like, that a random person, and it was part of Aslan's plan, and that's great. But just in terms of a narrative, it's never quite sat right with
me. I don't see him as random. I think you have to look at, I look at it as two things, and maybe I'm being too forgiving here. Fine, whatever. I'll play devil's advocate. I'm advocating for my own position.
Okay.
But one, Aslan's known him. He's not new to Aslan. He's also not a random guy. And you look at how he answers to the charges. He says, will you be king? Well, can you plow a field?
Yes.
You know, will you
raise food out of here?
Will you treat these animals kindly? And one of the segments of it I love, and if I can go on a spiel here for just a minute.
That's what editing's for. I mean, yes, go ahead.
This line where he says, enemies will come against Narnia. Will you be the first in the charge and the last in the retreat? And he gives the honest answer. He says, I hope so. I'll try. I won't know until the moment comes. You know, he gives the honest, good faith answer. But the things that Aslan is asking of him, and that stuck with me since I heard it as a little kid. I would sometimes forget some of the other lines and stuff, some of the other charges, but that one stuck with me, and I've wondered why. And I think that part of it, I think that Lewis is getting something that's more than just this romantic notion of, well, the king is the first in the charge and the last in the tree. Because you look around in our society in terms of the people in leadership, and yes, it could be, you can think in a military aspect, but you can think of even like business, politics. How many people are willing to put themselves in a position where the onus is truly on them?
Yeah.
If it goes badly, they will be the ones to suffer. And you don't see that very often. And even in the military context, I've read a few books on military history and tactics and stuff, and it doesn't always make sense in actuality to be the first in the stack, to be the first in the charge. However, those people still show up and those opportunities still arise. If you, a couple examples, if you read Lone Survivor or watch the movie, you know, Lieutenant Mike Murphy or Lieutenant Commander Christensen, guys who were like the senior guys who took on the most risk. You know, if you ever see the movie We Were Soldiers, it's a fantastic book. It's probably the only book that's ever made me cry. The book is, has a better title, We Were Soldiers Once and Young. And Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore vows to his men, it's portrayed beautifully in the film. He says, I will be the first to step on the field and I will be the last to step off. And he keeps his word. And in that sense, it makes sense. He has to be the one to assess what's going on. He has to understand the risks that his men are under. They try to pull him out and he has to be able to be there to be able to command his men and lead them. But it's such, you realize in that moment, it's such a rare thing. And it's not just this romantic, oh yeah, I'll be first in the charge and I'll be last. I think Aslan's asking him, will you take on the onus and the responsibility where, because so many people position themselves where if it goes well, they get the credit. But then, well, it's someone else's fault, or at least they don't suffer if things go bad. If the plan fails, if the business goes down, they're not going to be the ones who really take the hit.
Right.
But how often do you see that where he's like, no, no, if it goes badly, this is the guy who will pay the price because it's his decision. And you don't see that. And I think Aslan's charging him with that and asking him, will you be that type of person who will put yourself before the needs, put the needs of others before the needs of yourself? And it's a really good testament to the character, just not so much in what the cabbie's saying, but I would say, one, Aslan knows who he is, and two, what he's asking him to do, because it's very different than what we think of as a king. A king is someone who sends someone else out to do the dirty work. Someone else, send someone else out to get killed. Have someone else plow the field.
Someone very grand and important and polished.
Make sure you know that you're more important than all these other people and they're just underlings to you. That's how we think of how a king treats people.
It shows in those few sentences what Aslan values in a leader and in a ruler, and the things that he considers to be adequate qualifications, and just lays it out very simply. And you see that is all that's needed, and the cabbie fits that well, which is why he is a good person to become king.
Yeah, the stuff Aslan, just kind of the bullet points here, the stuff Aslan asks the cabbie about to see if he's ready to be king. He says, can you raise food out of the earth? Can you rule fairly, remembering that they're talking beasts, not dumb beasts? Will you raise your children and grandchildren to do the same? Will you not have favorites amongst them? And then, of course, will you be the first in the charge and the last in the retreat? I agree with everything you guys have said intellectually. But in terms of narrative, it's tough when, he was just introduced a couple chapters ago, right in the middle of this whole other plot about the madness of trying to get the witch back into the wood and back into Charn and yada yada. So it's just on a narrative level, like, could he have subtly introduced him in one of the first couple chapters, just to know that he was there, so it wasn't just a guy out of nowhere? And again, maybe having it be just a random guy plucked off the street plays more into what Lewis is trying to do. And I know that in the Talking Beast Facebook group, Polona said, she talked about Aslan saying, and as Adam's race has done the harm, Adam's race shall help to heal it. And Polona says, I kind of wonder if Frank was made king solely for the purpose of helping to heal the evil, or was it the plan from the beginning to have a human king? So maybe this is part of Aslan's solution to the problem.
No.
Yeah. But that's still, again, intellectually a really interesting idea. But just in terms of narrative, it's something I've just kind of wrestled with and gone back and forth on.
It's interesting that he wants people. He brings people into Narnia, you know, through either directly or indirectly. You can think of whether it's Frank and Helen or the Calormans, the pirates who become Telmarines. So there's all these, but it's interesting that he wants to bring in these people from outside. He doesn't just like make them up in Narnia, presumably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to do a brief word on how to film some of this stuff. How this
good luck. That's what we're all thinking.
If we see a Magician's Nephew movie, how much of this will actually end up in there? How much of the creature is talking about Uncle Andrew?
Not much.
We'll get in there. And is that fair? I mean, because I look at it and I go, I can't imagine this being in a movie. But then I go, well, maybe that's a reason it needs to be in there then. You know, maybe this means it's special to Narnia. And if you chop that stuff out, you're just going to end up with another generic fantasy movie to throw on the pile.
like, I'm a Tolkien guy who I go back and forth on Tom Bombadil. No, seriously, I will defend Tom Bombadil to the end of the age. And I love Tom Bombadil. I think the chapter adds so much. I think it's great. And I don't know how you would do it in the mm-hmm. film, you know,
because it does bring the narrative to a halt for the most part.
Yeah, unless you want to do the, well, it's let's wait 25th anniversary. Let's release the 40-hour cut of the Lord of the Rings.
But it's like, is there? We talked before about like, to what extent is there just something inherent about a movie that it doesn't really support these kind of exploration and rabbit trails as much
narrative wise, like the Uncle Andrew stuff. I actually think that if I were to be a betting man, I would bet they will have something with this in the movie if they make a movie, mm-hmm. but it'll be towards the conclusion,
right?
After, spoiler alert, all the stuff later with the witch, yeah. when that's concluded and you come back and you see what's been happening with Uncle Andrew, they'll like, because they'll feel like mood wise they can do some comedy and some lighthearted yeah. stuff.
It'll be the villain gets his due.
Yes.
You know,
that's
kind
what
of
I
ending.
Think, that's what uh-huh. I think we would see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have two concerns about this being in the movie. Number one is, yeah, like, is it just, there's, when you watch a movie, we talked this before, there's a number of things that you tend to want to, if you're seeing it, it's important. It's driving the story forward more so than in a book. There is something a little bit inherent about that. But also I think just technically, just having presumably a lot of CG creatures talking to each other. I mean, personally, I just don't think anyone has really nailed talking animals on film. I think Aslan, what in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie
you
was.
You never saw Gordy?
Nope. Sorry. But
it was one of those rushed to production films. They saw Babe was coming out. They're like, oh, shoot. Let's make another version of that, like Russian production. And what they did was they would give each animal something to chew on and they would roll film.
No.
So each animal is just like chomping on something and they dub it.
There've been some good ones and there've been some bad ones, but even the good ones, like Aslan and the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the Beavers, I think of those as some of the better ones. But to me, they've never quite gotten to the level of being more than just impressive special effects. It's still like, that's Peter. He's a real person, a real character. And there is Aslan. He's a effect, a good effect, but still an effect. And so no one has quite cracked a believable talking animal. I think it forces you to do things with the anatomy of the animal face. They're just, we know that's not right. We know that's not how they move. We know that lion lips can't form those words, for example.
Well, it's the whole like uncanny valley things. Like the closer you get to realism, the worse it's gonna look. Because you're like, that's, your brain is like, that's not going to work. Whereas if you make it obviously like it's a puppet and you're meant to use your imagination to fill in the blanks,
maybe that'd be better. I don't know.
You have a lot easier time to accept it personally. And I don't know if that's the way to go with a movie.
It was fascinating to watch like the live action version of The Lion King. They tried to do like move their faces as little as possible because they didn't want to bend the actual animal anatomy. That was the direction they tried it, and it didn't work. They were just animals with human voices coming out of them.
I never saw the movie. But I heard people say like, yeah, because what they wanted was any like still shot you would take is like, that's a realistic looking animal. It's not like, you know, but yeah, people just kind of like, but they didn't have the emotive qualities of a character.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this is one more reason, maybe one of the bigger reasons that, do Narnia and animation. Like 2D animation is the way to go.
I will tell you a movie that where I'm just thinking, because I'm thinking back like, oh, you're right. It's hard to think of like a movie where you buy the characters other than like a cartoon like Lion King, right? Where you completely buy the characters, you're invested in the characters.
Oh, because they're so stylized. It's 2D animation.
Right. But I was thinking the Black Beauty movie has all-star cast, has Sean Bean in it. The Black Beauty movie they did in the 90s where everything was narration, like the character is like speaking, but it's narration and it's like in his head. The horse isn't moving his mouth.
Yeah. But you kind of sort of believe it, you know, I know what you're talking about.
I mean, I will say that I was thinking like that one. I'm like, okay, you know what? That one, I was invested in the horse as a character.
Yeah.
You know, but I also, I was using my imagination. I'm not, you know, the horse isn't like, and the horse in his mind, he's speaking to the people, you know, and they're kind of speaking back. It's not like a dialogue, you know, because it's a horse, right? But I will say, I was like, maybe, I don't know, maybe you do have to step back from realism to use your imagination more, you know, because I'm thinking like that would be like one of the exceptions. That's like maybe one of the ones where I was like, yep, it's a real horse and it's a real character. Like that is the character mm-hmm. of the story. And I was able to get fully invested in it.
Yeah. Or you could just do animation. I don't know. But look, if someone, it would be pretty exciting if Narnia was the first movie to really nail talking animals. That would be pretty cool.
Something struck me at the play, at the backstage pass with the, for the horse and his boy. And I don't remember if they said it with you guys when you were there or when it was my family.
The horse and his boy at the Logos Theater.
There were some proportions of the horse they intentionally changed for the anatomy because they found even if it made it more realistic, it didn't work for the mind. So they said there are some proportions on the horse's body that are intentionally wrong, but they found it just worked better. I'd be kind of curious. Yeah. They didn't really go into detail on what some of those were. But actually, like, if you kind of look at it, like, the horse's, the head is, like, a different size to the neck. And, like, you know, so, but there were some things that they found through trial and error.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you got to go with what feels right. Because if everything is anatomically correct, but it doesn't feel right, well, then what's the point?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they had to go for that gut feels right versus, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's art.
Because the whole thing with like the beavers was like in the first movie was like, oh, they're, you know, they're CGI beavers and they sound good. They sound real, in, you know, but like, yeah, they're the only like character where you're like, this is flawless was I felt like was Thomas.
I agree. And of course,
but then you're all the cheating stuff that you're cheating face and everything, you know.
Right.
You know, so
yeah. So obviously we'll have lots of discussion. Possibly we'll see if they do a Magician's Nephew movie soon. Hopefully one day we'll see how all that comes together. But for now, that concludes our discussion of The Magician and His Nephew Are Both in Trouble. That's where we leave them. And in a future podcast, possibly the next one, we'll continue with Chapter 12. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Beast, the Narnia podcast. Visit narniweb.com to join our community and stay up to date on the latest Narnia news. Please post a comment or question below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. Special thanks to all of our Patreon supporters, especially our Knights of Narnia Web. Until next time, further up and further in.